And welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Snack Time with Mike and Ant. I'm one of your co-hosts, Ant Testor, a writer of names and flavor text for Wizards of the Coast and articles at Gathering Magic. With me, as always, interrupting me, as always, is the one and only super flavorful Mr. Mike Linneman, master of Weens.
Okay, Weens stands for Wiener Dogs. It's a shorthand thing, but no one cares about us today because we have a guest, Ant. We got a guest. Who's here with us?
We have a guest. We have member of the Wizard of the Coast creative team, Kimberly Crines.
Hi.
I said that right?
Well, it's Crinus, but you know.
Crinus. Okay. Crinus. See, that's why we do podcasts. You never know. You never know.
The more you know.
To put it in perspective, we've had like probably 15 guests. I have never gotten a last name right.
No,
Well, at least you have a record going. So.
Yeah, right? I'm undefeated.
You won't want to break your streak. Yeah.
He's going to be butchering them in the future episodes on purpose. So before we even get into who you are, what you do, we need to start up hot flavor gems for the week by Kimberly Crinus. I'm going to keep using it. Ant, start us up for the day. What do you got for us for a flavor gem?
All right, so my flavor gem is Street Savvy. Okay. This is from Old School Ravnica Block. I picked this card because, as I talked about on our last episode, I've been working on a cube where I'm trying to capture a very political, conspiracy-esque theme across all five colors, and green has been giving me a really tough time. Word. And I stumbled across this card, and I just really love the idea or the flavor that green creates a tactical advantage because they know the lay of the land better than you. Mm. And I think that's something that we don't really see that often as like a mechanic across green. And I think it's very flavorful, and I would just love to see more of it.
Okay. I like that a lot.
Yeah. I dig. I mean, obviously, if you're bringing out your planeswalking creatures, which always made me laugh in like 1997 to be like, I'm gonna planeswalk.
Yeah, you know? It was an antelope though.
Yeah, I know. It was super fun in like early Magic.
Yeah, but it's not even like the land walk, just that idea in general of hey, I took the time to learn this area and become familiar with this landscape, and that alone is enough for me to gain an advantage over you. Like that, I think that idea is very solidly green.
I can dig that. They know areas better than others.
Though. Right. Maybe not people.
No, not so much. Yeah. All right. Well, I'll go. Kimberly, we'll let you go. We'll let you go last in here so you can get a little taste of it. I chose not only because we have a creative team member that does, you know, writes a lot of wonderful things. I picked Right Into Being. Brand recent card by our boy, Young Hao Han. He also is on the team that made the Blendoku app, where it shows different shades of colors and different like hues, and you need to like put them in order. It's an amazing little app. It's like free, super cool. I always promote it because it's fun to play when you're bored in airports. But back to the card. Just an interesting concept of, you know, manifesting cards, top of your library. But since I'm the art guy, this is one of the Ugin's Fate cards. If you remember the Fate Reforged, you got a pack with two cards in it. It's a pack of two cards, which in all those packs are like $10, which is ridiculous. And the cards would have alternate artwork. And usually it'd be like the Spirit Dragon kicking it in the background or something goofy or, you know, Chris Ron's amazing, you know, different Planeswalker. But I just really like this idea that the alternate art doesn't necessarily need to be an FNM promo. It doesn't need to be a pre-release promo. It could be this other thing of, oh yeah, there's like this mini set of who did fake cards. And, you know, there's a few of them. They're kind of cool. There's only 26 and you could collect them all as this side super flavorful Vorthos thing. And whenever I can see them, I try to pick them up from places because usually they're like an extra quarter or something. And I like the idea that our guest today literally takes things out of nothing and writes them into being.
I love that segue.
Nice. Yeah. Planned out.
Yeah. It's almost as if we're professionals or something.
Yeah. Used to be, at least. Used to be. Kimberly, what do you got for us?
So my flavor gem is Switcheroo. Switcheroo is not only my flavor gem, it's my jam. Okay. So I'm a dragon girl. I always have been. I just love dragons. A fascination since oh my god, since I was like 5 years old. And switcheroo, kind of like you were saying, Ant, I went with something that was a little different for the color pie. Dragons on a blue card are not as common. And this art struck me when it first came out. It's a Kev Walker piece. And the dragon, he's being clever here. And that's not something you always see with dragons. You know, dragons are big and smashy and fire-breathy. And this guy, you know, he's being a little more subtle. He's got a little snark going on. And as the package, this card just, it won my heart. It's got the art that has a little heart in it. And I just really love it.
It does have a heart in it.
It does.
I never noticed that until just now. Oh, their snouts make a heart with the energy.
Yeah.
Oh, no. That's like a, that could be like a Valentine's Day card right there.
Loving it. Yeah.
I love this card now. That's too funny. He totally did that on purpose.
Oh, of course, for sure. He must love dragons too.
He totally did it. So and this is also one of the color shifted cards from painted to final. So the actual painting that Kev Walker made is the dragon's actually green.
Really?
It's green. No, I do not kid you. Just now. So now when he changed it, I don't really know. But in digital after the fact, he somehow got decided that he was going to change it, or he wanted to change it, so that the painting, and I'll put it in the show notes, it's a green dragon, which totally changes the concept, being a D&D background for me, that a green dragon, I'm like, oh, they're the dumb dragon, but the red dragon is like the smarter one of the bunch, which I'm sure James Wyatt wouldn't be nodding in the background if he's sitting behind you.
Right.
Super fantastic gem. Dig it on the day. As long as we're right here, Kimberly, who are you? What do you do for Wizards of the Coast on a day-to-day jam?
Well, let's see. So my title, I'm a creative designer. I'm on the story team. I'm fortunate enough to have a spot on the team that I have, you know, dreamed of being on forever. I do a lot of things, starting from, you know, leading the Names and Flavor, and for some sets, world building for some sets. I do some of my favorite things, design liaison. So we get to work with the design and development teams, actually, you know, designing cards, and that's really sweet. Play testing. I can't believe that's part of my job. It's like, pinch yourself.
Please go take your lunch and then play Magic for like an hour. Okay.
Sure. Well, if I must, you know, twist my arm. And then my absolute favorite thing, the writing of Magic stories for web fiction. It's just, that's my passion.
All right, so we're going to put you on the spot immediately, and you have to pick your favorite Magic story that you've written thus far.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, all right.
You have to pick a child.
Yeah.
And say that that's your favorite child.
I'm definitely between two. I think it's going to be Under the Silver Moon with Hal and Elena.
That was really popular on Tumblr. Holy cats.
Yeah.
Holy cats.
You were like the favorite for like 2 months straight worth of memes. People just losing their minds about it.
I'm so glad that everybody loved them as much as I did. It was, you know, this story was so much fun to write. The characters just, you know, it was one of those times that the characters speak to you, and it was great.
So on that note, you get to really go into depth with talking Magic story. Is that a thing that you find often to be a nuance of the job, is how much story can you put into an art description versus not enough in case you're working on those or in world building, for example?
Sure. So, I mean, everything you write, you know, you have to sort of write for the audience / for the next artist who's going to be using your description, as it were, as a tool. So, like, you know, my writing style changes depending on what you're writing. A piece of fiction, then you just get to, you know, go on and on, hopefully not too long-winded so people stop reading, but, you know, as long as you can indulge, you can indulge yourself.
Fair.
As a writer.
That's a good way to say it, sure.
Yeah. And if you're writing, you know, then you have your world guides. It's more encyclopedic writing. But it's very cool, in my opinion. I mean, I'm a scientist. I have a background in biomedical engineering, and so I have read a lot of, you know, encyclopedic references, and I find that in writing I really enjoy as well. So you're describing things, you're giving details. I do have to like pull myself, rein myself in, and say, no, let's not get down that rabbit hole.
right.
Sorry. And then you have, like you mentioned, the art descriptions for art on cards. And that is succinct. That is as few words as you possibly can use to tell the best, most poignant story that you possibly can. And it's kind of like, I would compare it to screenwriting, where you're setting a scene, you know, you're saying like, interior, this, and like, but it's not, you're not telling a story that you're wanting people to enjoy the, you know, the beautiful words that you've laid down. You're really trying to write this as a tool for the artist to use.
Right. You're trying to establish a mood or some type of feeling or something like that.
Precisely. Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting. So you mentioned that you were a biomedical engineer, and that is fascinating to me because I'm, or was anyway, a mechanical engineer. And so I'm curious when and how you decided that you wanted to transition into being a writer.
Sure, yeah. So my journey to this place has been circuitous, to say the least. I started in biomedical engineering. I was a neuroscientist for a number of years. I got my master's in brain-computer interface devices. I designed and programmed an ipsilateral brain-computer interface device that is used for stroke rehabilitation. And it's so cool. I mean, the research is so cool because you're finding a way to, like, we had people playing the game Space Invaders. Just with their brain, like you're just thinking about moving right and left and shoot, and you know, the device we designed and the algorithm that we programmed, it took your neural signals, your impulses, and translated them into you know, control of this video game.
That's really cool.
So right, but that's what happened then, is like I was like, oh my God, what is going to happen next? Like the world is on the brink of this. And literally all I could do was think about writing about, you know, the science fiction that could come from this. And so a little history, I was a writer writing all my life. Like, again, since about 5 years old for real, like I used to, my mom would get me blank books, like just hardcover blank books, and I would just fill them. Like there's just shelves and shelves of stories. And I would like tell my brothers, I have two little brothers, they're awesome. One of them plays magic, the other one doesn't. They're still both awesome, I guess.
One's a little more awesome.
But I would like tell them these pet detective stories, like a series every night. I would tell them a new pet. There were these neighborhood kids and they were detectives and they solved pet mysteries. And so, but then I had sort of stopped writing, when I, you know, serious science, and it takes a lot of your brain power to like do all this stuff. And so, but I was so inspired, when I was doing this research that I just couldn't help it. I just started writing again and the words just came and I couldn't not write. And at that point, then I decided to go back to school. And I got an MFA in creative writing. I was a screenplay fellow in Los Angeles for a while. I wrote some shorts, worked on set, as a script supervisor. I really, really enjoyed the writing and collaboration that you get to do with screenplays and working with a team. And you know, the idea of a web series that's coming out and you're delivering content every week or whatever it was. And so I loved that. However, you know, while I found some amazingly brilliant, kind people in Los Angeles, I also encountered some people that I didn't care for. And I didn't know that it was the creative environment that I wanted to be in forever. And so I started looking for other places, other opportunities that I could do sort of what I did there. And Wizards came to mind. And I was like, that's a long shot, man. But I tried it. And I ended up here as an editor first, and then worked my way into the creative department. And there you go.
There we are now. All right. Well, that's pretty thorough how that works out. And it's comical to me that you have two former engineers on your team now.
Yes.
Because Mel is one,
oh,
too.
Oh, right. Yeah, Mel, too.
Yeah, we often geek out together.
I don't doubt that at all. Okay, well then, let's get into the nitty-gritty here. So, we just finished out Innistrad with Eldritch Moon. What role did you play in this? I mean, the set was out, you had something to base upon. Kimberly Kranitz in Innistrad in the Return to set. What did you work on there?
So, in Innistrad, so I joined the team, the creative team, when Innistrad was in flight in different stages. So the world building had already happened, and I sort of hopped in when we were planning the story. And so we were figuring out what the pivotal events were going to be, what story moments we were going to feature on the cards. And so that's where I really got to help and play a role on that, and, you know, with the team, and then the writer's room for all of the stories that came out of that planning. Yeah, how you best tell a mystery story and on a card set, and then also in fiction that you're releasing on a...
Okay, you teasing us all you want in this. So you have a writer's room.
Yeah.
And you planned out the pivotal events, the pivotal moments. So did you guys have like a flow chart? Did you have a timeline where you'd be like, all right, we're going to see some Emrakul tentacles here. Then we're going to talk about this. And did you like...
Then Jace is going to get dizzy.
No, I mean, was it like that? Did you?
It is. It's totally like that. I mean, you know, we have our cork board with little index cards that we move around. That's and crazy. We try to figure out what's the best time to see the details. And, you know, even balancing as far as, like, you know, I was in a lot of the art description, the brainstorming for all the card art. And, you know, it's as much as, like, where do you seed the hints and how many cards is appropriate? What kind of hint is too big of a hint? Like, how can we get people intrigued but not spoil and, you know, set up a mystery that feels satisfying but, you know, not, like, just wait till the end to dump it all on you. It's a balance, right. And, you know, it's a challenge, but it's fun. It's a fun challenge.
That's like a meeting. That'd be, like, the coolest meeting ever. Instead of hearing, like... budget reports, you'd be like, all right, I'm gonna argue with Doug that we need to get a bigger clue on a horse.
Yeah,
like,
we need a horse with five legs. No one will notice it, I swear. And everyone's like, no, there's no way. Like, everyone's totally gonna see that. And sure enough, like, I didn't even notice that horse had five legs until I watched a video where Jenna's like, oh yeah, this horse over here has five legs. And I was like, no way.
See, yep. That's awesome.
That was totally amped checking that out. But yeah, we have utterly enjoyed that, just to see this unveiling of, like, okay, we're pretty sure it's Emrakul. But at the same time, it's like, well, what if it isn't? And it seems like that was very, like, you had, like, all right, it's probably Emrakul, but here are the other red herrings that we can dangle in front just to see what will happen.
Okay. Every good mystery needs its red herrings.
Right. Yeah, I gotta say, I was really impressed with how you guys handled it, because, you know, one of the things that always happens with pivotal moments is that they come out when the set comes out, right? So,
yes.
You know, for example, in the Zendikar block, we knew that the Titans were going to get beaten by the Gatewatch because we had the cards before the story was in our at our fingertips, right?
Right.
Whereas for this set, like, we saw Emrakul going into the moon. So we're like, oh, well, that's the end of the story. We already know it. But then when we actually read that story, it was not how we thought about her going into the moon. Like, we thought, oh, the Gatewatch won, like, move on. But really, they didn't. And that twist alone, like, I thought that was really cool, because... You guys were able to get around that, like, otherwise annoying, you know, feature of having a story that comes out after we already know what's going to happen.
Well, I'm so glad you guys enjoyed it. Yeah, I mean, we really, really are striving to provide a satisfying, you know, transmedia experience. Like, you're seeing the story on the cards, and reading about it and, you know, hopefully talking about it and experiencing it through all sorts of venues. And we want everything to be, you know, duels and stuff, everything to be fun and still, you know, rewarding. So, yeah.
All right. So speaking of a transmedia experience and especially of depth that you're able to touch it in a variety of places, what's your creative process like? Say you're writing for someone like Nyssa. How do you go about that? Do you get in a cosplay costume on that day? Do you just like look at posters for the day and you're like, all right, I'm going to get in this elf head. Do you like go on a hike? Like, how do you prepare yourself for that sort of like really, I don't know, almost stressful thing? Because you're like, wow, a lot of people are going to read this. And this is, you know, kind of a big deal.
It's a really big deal. Yeah. I mean, for any writer, any artist, when you're putting something out there, it's part of yourself. Everything is, every piece that you create, everything you write, and, you know, so everything that people say about it, how they love it or don't like it or are meh about it, you know, it's there, and it's part of you, and so, you know, yeah, it's intimidating sometimes, but what I try to do is find the seed of the character that I can relate to, no matter if it is Nyssa, or if it is Ankle Shanker from one of my very first stories. So, you know, like you find there's a little goblin in me, not gonna lie, you guys. Like sometimes I just wanna like jump up and down and hit things. But so you find that and you figure out like, well, this is the heart of that character. This is the story that this is what I want them to experience in this story. And to me, that really helps lay the groundwork for whatever I'm writing. And then I kind of like to think of it as a sculptor with clay. So like, you know, you have this lump of clay and the first strokes that you make, you just say, well, here's going to be the head and this is going to be the leg. You can see what's going to happen here, but you don't work out the details. So I like to, you know, like broadly, you know, paint like in my mind, like the character's going to move from here to here. This is going to be the hardest thing that they're going to have to deal with in the whole story. This is going to be their high point, like when they really feel like they've made a difference or the catharsis or whatever it's going to be. So I just paint those broad strokes and I get that on paper. And I'll revise that a couple of times if I don't like it. And then after that, then just like, you know, sculptor again, to stick with the same metaphor, you go back in and then you do the details. And you know, I'll dive into one scene. Maybe it's the scene that speaks to me. So maybe it's like at the end and I start carving that out and you figure out all the little things and the nuances. And then that informs another of the scenes in the story and another, you know, all the way down to like the hairs on the follicles of hair on your, you know, fingers, like all of that, you know, you're putting it together until you have a piece that really feels whole.
That's understandable. I'll go through drafts all the time, and I'm guessing luckily you also have the ability that you can, you know, sometimes take a little half an hour at one in the workday, and you just steal a room and you just write things.
Yeah, I mean, we try to find some quiet space when we are assigned a story for the, you know, so we have the same as the writer's room, which I mentioned, like, you know, we bring a draft to our team and they get to all take a look at it. And we all talk about it and what's working and what we like and what we don't like. And then it's those little details as well. You know, each story is so important to the overall arc that we're telling. And especially, you know, for something like a mystery story, every detail is, you know, really holds a lot of weight.
Right.
So it's like you're delivering on the expectations of your team and this overall story you're telling. And you know, sometimes it may conflict with what you were planning in your head if you could selfishly write the story. So you have to,
right,
balance that and try to make it the best for everything. You know, serve your character the best, serve the overall arc the best, serve the individual standalone story to the best of your ability.
So which do you enjoy more then? Do you like taking something that's already got that kind of base set, that established character, established world, and fleshing that out more? Or do you like the raw creative process of saying, hey, we need to create an entirely new world with entirely new cultures based around, I don't know, Greek mythology, go. and you're just kind of like left to your own whims to kind of throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. Like, which one of those do you find yourself enjoying more?
That is such a hard question because I really like both. I do. Like, there are, and I don't know if I would be as happy if my job was just one of those things all the time. I like that it's a variety and that some days I get to throw things at the whiteboard and have a dry eraser if I don't like them. And I like that some days I, like, you know, I can write a story and craft every word and wordsmith it, and it's permanent and it stays there. So I like both processes. And I think, you know, it's fun because your brain gets to work in two different levels. Like, when you're making something new, there's no wrong answer. And that's really fun and really liberating. Maybe that's the goblin in me that likes to do that. And
it's possible. very much possible. Okay, well, on that, then, the perfect example of where that is writing names and flavor text. You know, if there's a reprint, you get new flavor. You get to flesh it out as new again. Or writing someone brand new, you get to name a legendary creature. So for people that do watch this, there's always the people that want to do names and flavor text, and that's a separate episode. But say someone was getting into it. What would you recommend? Because I think all three of us have done this. I've publicly admitted many times that I'm terrible at it. I'm an art guy.
I love it. I know. I could write names and flavor text all day. It's got to be my. I've never had a medium where it's just because it's so restricting.
It's stressful.
But it gets the best out of you. Like, no, as a writer, you realize, like, I have this great idea. I need to shrink it down into like 15 words.
Yeah, the constraints I think sometimes help the creative process and the names and flavor.
But sometimes you could see other people submit it, and then you could see some fire in there, and you're like, oh man, that one's really, really good. Biscuits.
Right, but then the competitive nature in you is like, I got to come up with something even better than that. Like, it's like when you see like a pole vaulter, they hit whatever feet, and you're like, I'm going to do that much and 1 inch. Like, that's what I need to do.
That's a great way to find inspiration.
That's a fair way to do it. So Kimberly, when you do that, how do you go about doing that? Because obviously there's other games out there too that have this sort of concept. And anybody that wants to gain that skill, wants to gain more than just a long-form novelist and needs to be able to write really concise gaming flavor. Any recommendations or any advice you would give to someone that wants to get into that?
Yeah, so I think there's two vectors to look at names and flavor. One is looking at the card as it stands alone, and the other is taking a look at the whole set and the story that you're telling. So I'll just touch on both of those briefly. The first, like, you're looking at one card. You want to deliver the most satisfying package that you can to the consumer of that card. When they pick up that card and they're just holding that one card, you want the, like, art to pop. You want the name to, you know, elevate what they're seeing. You want the flavor text to, like, send home that final punch that is, like, a knockout, and it just makes it, it's just brilliant. Like, you're looking at it, you're like, oh, this was so cool. I just really loved this experience. So when you're writing for that, I would say, you know, taking a look at what the art already provides. You don't want to provide the same thing in a title. You want to provide something that is going to elevate it. Like I said, you want to take a look at it from just a slightly different direction. You know, you want to figure out a way to add to what the whole story of the card is. And then flavor text, I mean, oh my goodness, you nailed it when you said concise. Like, it is packing your punch into a very small space, and it's being smart about how you do it. Again, like, what can you say in the name of the card that's going to tell part of the story so you don't have to use those words in the flavor text?
Right.
Go ahead, yeah.
I was just going to say, I think Matt Cavada, in like a really old article, he said this. I'll never forget reading this, but he said that in flavor text, the idea isn't to take a simple idea and make it really complex and flowery and whatever. It's to try to take a really complex idea and get it into as simple form as possible.
Like, yeah, it's true, because it's like you're consuming the players, the readers, they're consuming this one little experience. And yeah, you want it to be, you know, breathtaking in that moment, if it can be. You want it to make them like stop and be like, oh, this was cool.
Right. You want them to be happy that they took the time to actually read it.
Exactly.
That's how I try to look at it. Like, anytime I submit a line, I'll read it and go, like, if I open this pack and I got this card and the card said what I just wrote, would I be satisfied that I spent 2 seconds? Because, I mean, we're in a, you know, a day and age now where, like, those 2 seconds, I could have done something cooler on Twitter or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, was it worth my time to read that?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's, like, for me, the best is anytime you get it to the point where not only are they happy that they read it, but they're excited to quote that card the next time they play it. Like, if you can create something that evocative, that's really my goal, is to try to get the player so excited about it that they're like, I can't wait to play this counterspell against Mike and quote this card and make him feel twice as dumb for thinking that he could get away with whatever shenanigans.
Or will you get, you know, Force of Will and Commander? And,
all right, well, that's a different, that was a different game. In this scenario, I come out on top, okay?
Nailed it. Right, we there's a story about Ant and I playing Commander with Robert Schuster, and Schuster played a Force of Will, and it was...
So I played a 17 mana... what is the card? It's from Khanza Tarkir block. It's like a black, green, blue X spell where you get to, like, look at your opponent's X cards in their deck and steal everything. I blew all of my, like, Gilded Lotuses and everything that I had, and he was just like, Force of Will. And I was sad.
Oh, that is sad. I'm sorry. Yeah.
It was a slow reveal though, and it made.
He just had this, like, you know, smile on his face the whole time. It was just, he enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. The card is Villainous Wealth.
Villainous Wealth, that's it.
Villainous Wealth. Yeah. And it was pretty much daggers after that. It was pretty comical. Yeah. Okay. So on that note, talking about each super evocative flavor, talking about really, really great cards. One of my personal favorites is Rancor, which has arguably top 5 flavor text of all time. You know, absolutely.
Hatred outlives the hateful.
Which is exactly what the card does, and it has this, like, such an evocative feeling on what an elf could be, and elves aren't always friendly, and you're like, ooh, hate elves? You know, it really gets you thinking about them. Kimberly, do you have a couple cards that really have stood out to you in terms of flavorful things? Maybe not always name, maybe not always flavor text, maybe art and artist things too, if we want to delve into that.
Yeah, let's see. Well, you know, so since I've been here, the cards that I have been just most excited about that we are making are the ones that represent the story moments. I just can't, you know, it's such an exciting thing, I can't even describe it, but, like, to see these story moments that we're writing about on a Magic card, like, oh my god, like, it's like, there it is, there's Nissa and Chandra, like, casting the spell to take down Ulamog, and it's happening, it's right on this card. So for me, that's cool, because it comes out of such a collaboration with the design and development team. Sure. So, you know, we'll say these are the moments of the story we would love to highlight in the set, these pivotal moments. And, right. You know, as a, you know, design liaison, you'll go and you'll sit with the design team and we'll talk about, well, what's the mechanic that's going to make people feel like they are Nissa and Chandra in that moment? Or, you know, like they are Sorin on making Avacyn or whatever the case is. Okay.
So it's very much a top-down thing where sure. You guys create these pivotal moments first, and then you go to the design team and say, hey, these are the moments that we need to see on cards.
Yeah, I mean, it's a back and forth. But yeah, we come up with the moments, and then with the design team, we try to work on the best way to represent them, what the mechanic could be. How to make you feel like as a player you're experiencing it not only through the art and the name and flavor text if it fits, but also through the gameplay, through the whole experience. So, in my mind, it just takes it all to a new level. And that's, I just think that's so awesome that, you know, the story has come to this point.
Right. Yeah, I'm always amazed when the card is actually able to capture that feeling in the gameplay itself. Like, I think it's one thing to really, like, nail a name or get really good flavor text or have the art that totally hits the pivotal moment. But when you actively have gameplay that completely represents what's happening in the story, it really makes the player feel like they're getting immersed into that media in a way that's unlike a lot of other medias out there, right? Like, if I want to be Tamio and Nissa in, you know, the latest story, I can play that card on Emrakul and turn her into a land, basically, and really understand and really feel that moment, you know? Or even if it's as simple as using Savage Punch on my legendary teamer and have him punch a bear.
Exactly.
Like I can do that in the game. Like I can live that moment, and that to me is it's rare when that happens, and when it does, it feels so worth it.
Oh, I'm so glad, and I love it. Yeah, I love it, and I love how. Oh, yeah.
Okay, we on that, we need to talk about this, whether this was a thing at work for you. So Pro Tour that happened, you know, not long ago.
Yeah.
It's exactly this was a topic of conversation at work. I hope.
Yes, that's.
Please tell me it was.
Say that it was, yeah, absolutely. That was exactly what it was about on the tip of my tongue was when we see Liliana defeating Emrakul. Like, how cool is that? Like, you know, we couldn't have asked for better as a story, as a flavor team. Just it's like, yeah, clearly, duh, Liliana is gonna win. But that's, you know, the fact that the mechanics and the gameplay ended up working out that way is just I was so happy.
At the Pro Tour. That's the key thing. So for those of you people that missed it, so there was a match at the Pro Tour in one of the games, in one of the finals that had an Emrakul out and a Liliana that ultimated, making all, and then Liliana won the game. And that has never happened before. And the closest comparable would be like during Innistrad block, if someone brought out Liliana of the Veil and Thalia was on the other side and they had a Hell Vault out and Liliana goes ultimate and the Hell Vault, like, they
happen to have Avacyn and Grizzlebrand in
both inside, and then the next turn Liliana, like, kills Grizzlebrand. Like, it'd be the weirdest.
It'd be pretty complicated.
It'd be so weird. But
I think the easiest kind of one would just be if somebody was playing like a Phyrexian based deck and the other guy had legacy weapon, and won using legacy weapon.
That could be cool too.
Like that's an old school reference, but still, I mean that's the same. That's kind of like the same idea that, like, to see that at the Pro Tour though is, you know, even better, because most of the time the story isn't on the best card in the set. You know, it's the best card in the set's like a 4/4 Raptor that doesn't mean anything. You know, it's like, whatever. It's a great card, but does
not
it prove,
wrong.
Like,
You're
it
not
doesn't
wrong.
Matter to the story.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, this was just so exciting. I felt like, you know, I jumped off the couch and was screaming. Like, I was so excited. So it was cool to see her win.
I would love to see that, like memo from creative team to organized play. Yes, do this again. Love creative. That's it. And there's, like, cookies or something, like, passed along.
Yeah.
Just utterly astonishing. Okay, well, that's fantastic to hear, because we, you know, nobody really heard about it, but we love seeing that as Vorthos people. It's the stuff we couldn't do back in the day, and if pivotal moments keep continuing on, which I hope they do, that we can see more of that in the future to really tie into, you know, those Vorthos gameplay moments, which Ant, I know, loves and lives for.
Yeah, I live for them too. They're pretty spectacular when they happen.
It's the best. It's the best. It's just sweet. It adds. It just adds an extra layer, to it. It makes it feel worth it.
It does make it
feel
worth it.
It really does.
You know, like, it also. It's like the payoff at the end, because it's not going to happen every time. You know, and so it's like the investment you put in, and like blood and sweat and tears that you put into deck building and making it happen, and then when it pays off, you're just like, oh my god, that was amazing. Yeah.
Just incredible.
Pretty good.
So have you gotten the chance to do an actual world building yet? I guess you were on, were you on Kaladesh world building?
Yes, I was. That was the first world I built. Yep.
Okay. Were you the lead for that?
No, no, no. I'm a lead for an upcoming set, but not.
Okay. When that comes out in the future, there might be a phone call. There might be a situation to be like, Kimberly, what? Can we have you come back on?
Oh, another excuse to snack with you guys.
Okay, well, we'll get the snack attack going, as I can hear my wiener dog snacking on a bone next to me right now. Very, very fitting. I mean, one of these days we're going to literally bring them into a live session. It's going to happen. We would have had it at GP Portland, but there was a flight issue and so on.
Oh, that killed me. I was so sad when I couldn't make it.
The cosplay summit alone was incredible.
Oh, I know.
It was so good. There were so many.
We'll have to do one at Vegas.
Yes. Yes, well, hopefully we can get some creative team people, Kimberly, coming to Vegas to do something flavorful. Maybe there's a panel. I don't care. Something with some taste. We'll get some flavor. So with that, we don't want to keep you too long for tonight. We have more stuff coming. Conspiracies around the corner. Sean Main on the record is killing it with it.
Oh,
super
my
excited.
God, he totally is.
People on Twitter are just losing their minds. They're just like, Sean, thank you, love, random person. And he's just like giggling all day long, just giggles, you know, as his loud laugh is. And then Kaladesh around the corner, so we're so hyped about it. Want to thank you so much. I'm so excited. Is there anything else, as long as we have you here, that you know, you'd like to share to the other Vorthoses out there?
Oh, you know, I just want to thank everybody who's been reading the story and supporting us this whole time while we're delving into this sort of new world for, you know, storytelling through magic cards and you know, just coming along with us for the ride, because we love it so much and we only want everyone else to love it. And so I'm so thrilled that people are joining in and enjoying it, and I couldn't ask for more. So keep reading, keep talking about it, keep sending us comments and thoughts, and we love hearing from you all.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. And to get a hold of you, you're not hard to find. You are on the Twitter, literally first name, last name.
I am. Yes.
Well, there's a J. There's a J in there. Oh, is it for
no?
It's for
no,
Jerome.
There's no J. There's no J.
No J on Twitter.
There's no J.
Oh, there's
so,
not.
No, there's no J. It's in her name, not in the handle. Come on, Aunt. Come on. So you can find her there. You can find Aunt at Aunt Tessitore. Everybody knows. You can find me at Vorthos Mike. Even Snack Time Cast has a little Twitter feed, which we just talk about snacks most
it's
of the time.
Just dogs and yeah.
It's a lot of dogs. It's a lot of dogs snacking. Yeah, but. Thank you so much for, again, Kimberly. Hopefully we can talk to you soon. But yeah, thanks for watching today. And we'll be talking again, snacks, with our Patreons, which we're so happy to have real soon.